welcome to the April episode of the Axial Spondyloarthritis podcast series. Alongside our RA and PSA podcasts, we'll be bringing you monthly slide decks to help you keep up to date with the latest research and publications in the field of axial SPA. My name is Sofia Ramiro. I'm a rheumatologist and a senior researcher at Leiden University Medical Center and Zuiderland Medical Center. And today I'm joined by Hideto Kamera, Professor of Internal Medicine at Toho University, Xenophon Baraliakos, Professor of Internal Medicine and Rheumatology at the Ruhr University in Bochum, and Medical Director of the Rheumatology Center, Rheumatzentrum Ruhrgebiet in Herne, Germany. And finally, Atul Deodar, Professor of Medicine and Medical Director of Rheumatology Clinics in the Division of Arthritis and Rheumatic Diseases at Oregon Health and Science University in Portland. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the AxSpA podcast. If you would like more information on the papers we discussed today, please head over to the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum website at www.imidforum.com, where you can review full slide summaries of these publications. Now, Hideto, let's get started. Over to you.
Thank you, Sofia. In the first paper we will discuss today, the authors assessed long-term etanercept response in patients with radiographic axial SPA. In our second publication, we will discuss the comparison of tofacitinib and adalimumab in a real-world clinical context. Now, Xenophon, over to you.
Yes, thank you very much, Hideto. In our first paper, this is a recent publication where I myself and other colleagues contributed to entitled Long-Term Etanercept Response for Patients with Radiographic Axial Spondyloarthritis based on achievement of early, intermediate, or late responses during index studies. For the study background, we took studies that were based on treatment with etanercept. We all know it, it's effective, well tolerated in patients with radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. And we've seen in several studies that we have maintenance of the efficacy and safety of the treatment for up to 7 years after start. We, of course, all use the compound also in daily practice. And here we speak about a post hoc analysis that was designed to further investigate the time frame in which patients achieve clinical responses with etanercept. With respect to the methods, we used data from three phase three or four placebo or sulfasalazine controlled RCTs of etanercept index studies. We had two phase three trials where patients received placebo or etanercept for 24 and 12 weeks respectively. At that time, two times per 25 milligrams per week. We had one phase four RCT with patients receiving the 50 milligram dosing or sulfasalazine, and sulfasalazine was able to be titrated to a maximum of 3 grams per day with a duration of 16 weeks. And the primary endpoint for each study was a proportion of patients achieving ASAS 20 at week 12 or 16 or 24, respectively, based on the different studies that were used and where we had data available from. We also included data from open label extensions of the studies of the three respective index studies that were included, and the assessed visits there were weeks 34, weeks 36, or week 38. Now for the index studies and regarding the results, the patient responses differed significantly between etanercept and the other treatments. This means the control arms. When we analyze the data for achievement, for example, of ASAS 5 out of 6 outcomes, ASAS 40, ASDAS improvements, and BASTA improvements, within each index study, the proportion of patients who achieved either early ASAS 20 or early ASDAS CRP below 1.3, this means either the very easy to reach outcome or the much more difficult to reach outcome. This was greater in the arms treated with etanercept as compared with the control arm. Here, again, sulfasalazine or placebo. And then for achievement of early ASAS 20 response in the patients treated with etanercept, we had about 60% of patients who did that, this achievement of ASAS 20 early on, when they had a concomitant DMARD use, about 50 to 75%. without concomitant DMARDs, about 45 to 80% in patients with short disease duration of below 3 years, then 50 to 60%, somewhat smaller range, but nevertheless similarly high of those patients who had a longer disease duration of more than 3 years. And when it came to the more, let's say, tough outcome of ASDAS below 1.3 early on, there in patients with etanercept, there we had about, let's say, 6 to 26%. That's a little bit broader range because of the different studies. When they had a concomitant DMARD, and 15 to 23%, similar numbers without concomitant DMARD. So there was no big difference. And the same numbers, very similar results were seen when patients were treated when they were with etanercept early on. That means with a disease duration below 3 years or disease duration longer than 3 years, they were about, let's say, 17 to 22 and 11 to 27% respectively. So similar numbers also in these subgroups. In the open label extension studies, early and intermediate, as a 20 responders, there we saw ranges between 70 and 100%. And in another study where we had this analysis, we saw similar numbers, about 70 to 100%. So altogether, ASDAS 20 response was in fact seen for both early and intermediate responders in 3 out of 4 or 4 out of 4 patients in all these extensions. This means an increase in number as compared to the early assessment. Now, the numbers are a little bit confusing in terms of you know, the percentages, but these are obviously studies that have been conducted in a study setting, on a data that were conducted, taken from study setting. So we need to kind of conclude in terms of data related to clinical practice and daily practice. And what we can say is that the response in short-term index studies was maintained in the long-term open-label assessment, something that we know, but we have now reanalyzed in a larger group of patients. There were no response had occurred in the index studies. The continued treatment led to a response later on in a large proportion of patients, which answers the questions on whether or not sometimes it does make sense to continue on the treatment when patients have responded somehow. And of course, an early response during the studies appeared to be associated with response in the long-term extension. This means, on the other hand, absence of early response does not predict a non-response later on, which again answers the question on whether or not sometimes, again, based on the decision made in daily practice, it is helpful to continue treatment in patients who may not very fast show response. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Xenophon. Very interesting study, and I think now it's important to discuss it. And I would like to start with a comment and question for you about especially your last statement about the fact that an absence of early response was not associated with the lack of response on the long term. When hearing this, and immediately I found it a little bit counterintuitive, in the sense that we know data that when there is an early response, we know that there is a higher likelihood of response over the long term. You also show that with your own data. But now I'm thinking that perhaps that the statement that when there is no early response, there can still be a response later. Maybe we need to discuss what is early response here, because if I'm not wrong, in the paper it was defined as a response at 4 weeks, which is really early, and that's fantastic if it happens. But maybe when it does not happen, indeed, we can still wait. And those are the recommendations that we have, for example, in our ASDAS-EULA recommendations, to wait until 12 weeks to assess response. So I think here the term of early or non-early response is perhaps important. So we are talking about response at 4 weeks. If there is no response at 4 weeks, indeed, it is worth it continuing treatment, and patients can still show a response later. The question is, up to which time point is it reasonable to continue treatment if patients are not showing response. Can you comment on that, please?
Yeah, well, this is absolutely correct. And this study does not go against recommendations. The main purpose of the study was, in fact, there was two purposes. Purpose number one was to see if very early, indeed 4 weeks, responses, you know, make something, do have any meaning, or should we indeed rather wait for the 3 months that we rather recommend? And yes, this absolutely remains untouched. On the other hand, we need to understand that what we say, both in the recommendations but also in the studies, that was, they were obviously based on outcomes that are, you know, based on questionnaires, may not be what the patient feels. This means we're measuring something that we want to measure, we have said that we would measure, but we all know those patients who come from, let's say, a very high BASTA, for example, and they never reach a BASTA below 4, but they're very satisfied. And we continue in daily practice because they say, I don't want to change my treatment, I'm doing very well. And then we see the questionnaires and they are all showing high markers. So what I want to say by that is that we, of course, have recommendations. They are absolutely valid. This study shows, A, it does make sense to go shorter. But on the other hand, there may be patients where we should not very strictly hammer the recommendations into them and rather go alongside with their feeling, continuing on treatment, because at some point they will also reach the outcomes we wish, but they are nevertheless satisfied, which would be the reason not to switch treatment. Yeah, but this is more or less the translation of clinical of study data in a daily practice. But again, this is certainly that's not suitable for everyone.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think there were two things which struck me. The first one was what you are mentioning, Xenophon, and what Sophia said is that it is contrary to what I have always thought, that if the patients do not respond early, and of course the definition here is, you clarified, it's 4 weeks. In clinical practice, our definition for early is 12 weeks. I mean, we at least try a 3 months trial, at least that's what I do. And in 3 months, if the patient is not going to respond and not enough response, then I'm going to switch the drug. So this is 4 weeks. I agree it's too early. And once you explain that, then it becomes clarified that yes, I mean, 4 weeks is way too early to decide whether somebody is going to respond or not. The second thing, which also went a little bit against what I thought, was patients with early disease and, well, early onset of the disease and late onset. Now, here, the definition is 3 years. More recently, ASAS has changed that definition to 2 years. And so in general, I would have thought that patients who have less disease symptom duration would respond better. This is one of the things that has been seen in other studies. So that was a little bit of a surprise, that patients who have longer disease symptom duration have equal response as those who had early symptom duration. That was a surprise. And the third quick point I want to make is what you have been discussing, is that there is a difference between clinical trials and daily practice. And in clinical trials, you're right, patients stay on the drug for, you know, I mean, I participated in one of the golimumab studies, which was a 5-year study. And we, in fact, looked at patients who had not achieved even ASAS 20 response at the end of 5 years. And there were some patients, there were something like 15-20% of the patients. I think the ASAS 20 response in that 5-year study was 80%. I'm just thinking directly from my memory. And we were most surprised. Why are these people still in the study after 5 years when they don't even have ASAS 20 response? And as you said, Xenophon, there is something staying in the study, coming to the clinic, being seen by the doctor, being seen by the research assistant. I mean, there is a placebo effect to that, number one. And number two, what we are measuring may not exactly be what the patient is feeling value in. The patient is clearly feeling some value in staying into the clinical study after 5 years. And then we are somehow, our instruments are not measuring that. So that's always interesting. And so that's what happens in clinical studies as opposed to clinical practice, day-to-day practice, where if they don't really feel they're doing very well, they want to say that, no, I'm not doing well, very well, I need to change. So that's the difference between studies and daily practice.
Fully agree. And one thing to mention here regarding the disease duration, you have to know that analysis was done long ago before the recommendation came out. And secondly, indeed, we didn't have that many data for disease duration related years.
I would like to add to that, Atul, that I think it's indeed an important topic. And I think since we have the definition agreed within ASES, there are more studies in this. And we do see that there is a higher response in biologics compared to placebo in patients with shorter symptom duration. We also see that there is a higher response in the biologics group in patients with younger symptom duration compared to the longer symptom duration. We do not see a clear difference if we take both placebo and biologic arms into account. And there will be more data coming out being presented at EULAR. Personally, I wonder whether the 2 year is still the cutoff. In this case, we saw data with 3 years, but even the 2 year, whether it's really a cutoff where we can see a difference. It was a cutoff we agreed to define early versus established disease, also taking into account feasibility and the challenges in making the diagnosis and patients presenting to our clinics. But if we are wanting to make a difference in terms of early versus later treatment, maybe we will need to have studies with even an earlier cutoff of the symptom duration to try to find a contrast. And I think that's an ongoing topic and of interest. And I think and hope we will start seeing more studies in this area, especially now that we are working in this definition in the field. So okay. I think we can
you're right continue. So our judgment should be based on at least two steps. So initial response and final response. And for initial response, we usually use milder hurdle, kind of ASES 20 response or so. And for final response, we need more stringent criteria like ASES inactive disease. So if we see some response in initial phase, then we can wait and we can expect for more profound response. But if we do not see at least any change or any response for first 1 month or 2 months, then the expectation of we achieving the treatment target goal is much less in later phase. So we need some step-by-step judgment according to the response. Thank you, Zenfong.
So I think, thank you very much for the discussion. I think we can proceed to the second paper now, Atul, please.
Yeah, thank you. So the second paper is titled Comparative Effectiveness of Tofacitinib and Adalimumab in Axial Spondyloarthritis, a Real-World Clinical Context Multicenter Study. This is by Goswami and co-workers from India. So the background of this study is... I actually visited India just what 4 or 5 years months ago, and they have tofacitinib. There are about 8 generic tofacitinibs available, and so it is natural for the rheumatologists there to start tofacitinib early on nowadays, and they wanted to compare the effectiveness of tofacitinib and also the safety of tofacitinib compared to an established biologic like adalimumab, a monoclonal antibody. So the methods were they examined the case record. So this is a retrospective case record study of consecutive patients with ankylosing spondylitis or non-radiographic axial SPA patients treated either with tofacitinib or adalimumab. The cases that were examined were started on these drugs between July of 2021 and November of 2022. There were 135 patients who were started on tofacitinib. There were 131 patients started on adalimumab. And the efficacy outcome measures that they are going to compare between these two groups of real-life patients are the ASDAS response criteria for major improvement, for low disease activity, for inactive disease, as well as the BASDAI 50 achievement and changes in the mean BASDAI, changes in the mean ASDAS, and also changes in the C-reactive protein. They also wanted to see the tolerability, whether patients tolerate one drug better than the other. And they looked at that by looking at number of new adverse events, total adverse events, serious adverse events, drug discontinuation, and most importantly, cost effectiveness. Because as I said, tofacitinib, there are 8 generic tofacitinibs available in India. And the results showed that the baseline disease characteristics were comparable between these groups. Again, remember that this is just an observational study. There were some exceptions with the concurrent medication, and this is the first one that I'm telling you is a big difference. Patients who started on tofacitinib, 16% had tried previous TNF biologics compared to 8.4% in the adalimumab. So double the number of people who are starting tofacitinib had already experienced TNF inhibitor biologics in the past. Why they stopped their biologics is not really explained in the paper. In India, mostly it is stopped because of financial reasons. The mean improvement in BASDAI from baseline to month 6 was 3.14 for tofacitinib and 3.39 for adalimumab. So very comparable change in the BASDAI. Mean improvement in ASDAS up to month 6, also comparable, 2.07, 1.78. 2.07 for tofacitinib, 1.78 for adalimumab. Mean time to achieve ASDAS low disease activity was 4.4 months for tofacitinib and 3.9 months for adalimumab. Higher proportion of patients who were assigned to the adalimumab group achieved the low disease activity or inactive disease status by the 4th month compared with the tofacitinib. And this is, this is observational study. It's about 69% for tofacitinib, about 80% for adalimumab. So their conclusion is that the effectiveness of tofacitinib is similar to adalimumab, considering all the constraints of these types of observational studies in axial spondyloarthritis from this observational study. And adalimumab has a better early response. However, the responses are similar later on when you look at these drugs at 6 months. The response to adalimumab was faster and sustained with less chance of drug switching. However, there is significantly higher monetary cost for the drug to the patient. Tofacitinib showed comparable effectiveness with adalimumab in patients with axial SPA. This is their final conclusion, despite lesser response in the initial months, with a favorable incremental cost-effectiveness ratio. And that was the basic reason why this study was carried out. So I look at this, and I think this is a very interesting paper, and most of the data in daily practice on the targeted synthetic DMARD tofacitinib is probably going to come from India, because there are large number of patients being treated with tofacitinib, about the efficacy, about the safety, and other things as well. One thing, I'll just make one point and I'll open this to discussion, is one of the reasons I thought why tofacitinib patients did not respond quickly enough or quicker, as quick as adalimumab, was the big difference between the previous biologics that these patients had received, nearly double, 16% compared to 8% in the adalimumab group. But I would like to know your thoughts.
Thank you very much, Atul. I think your presentation was very good, and you very subtly hinted on all the points that one can want to comment on. It was very clear that you were always very making the point that these observational studies have methodological challenges when we're looking at efficacy. And also now the point that you're making, that you made, of the big difference in terms of insufficient response being much higher, doubled in tofacitinib group versus the adalimumab group. And also now your comment, I would also say that it's almost counterintuitive that we see that a JAK inhibitor is having a slower response compared to a TNF inhibitor. But we have to put this into context of the patient population that we have. It's a more difficult to treat patient population when there are more patients with insufficient response to previous biologics. I think the truth is that it is very challenging to compare the efficacy of two drugs in an observational study where patients are not randomized, and there are reasons for which physicians chose for one or the other drug. What I think is very important here and is very valuable is also what you mentioned, that in India there are so many patients that are being treated and will be treated with tofacitinib. And I think the ironic situation is that is because of economical reasons. Now, if you go to other countries, we see that TNF inhibitors are given first line, especially biosimilars, because of economic reasons, and JAK inhibitors are reserved for a later line because of costs. So I think that the richness of data coming from India will be indeed that a lot of patients are being exposed to tofacitinib and JAK inhibitors, and from them we can learn indeed what is happening. Perhaps not so much about efficacy because of these challenges, but perhaps about safety, because we see some contraction in the rest of the world in the prescription of JAK inhibitors after oral surveillance, after some warnings from FDA and EMA. And in India, that situation is different also because of economic constraints. And it will be very interesting to understand, and hopefully they will be measured, and we will have our colleagues conducting good studies measuring these safety outcomes. Will they really see more cardiovascular events in these patients that they are treating with the tofacitinib? And what will be the long-term safety profile of these patients widely treated with the tofacitinib and JAK inhibitors? I think we should keep our eyes open to our Indian colleagues in that sense, and to what they will be experiencing, so that they can share with us. What do you think, Ireto, about this?
Thank you. And I'm very interested in ISO. So it may predict our future treatment status. So more and more JAK inhibitor generics are available, currently not available in Japan. Then our recommendation or treatment algorithm may change. So it can suggest our future prescription. So it's very interesting. Thank you, Atu.
So, sorry, are you saying there is no JAK inhibitors in Japan for treatment of XLSPI?
No. No generics. JAK inhibitor generics available. Yes. Generic. So that's a big difference. So JAK inhibitor is more expensive than biological DMARDs. That's why.
Oh, that is very interesting.
And that was exactly the same comment that I made from several other countries, namely in Europe, there where biosimilars of TNF inhibitors are substantially cheaper than JAK inhibitors. So this is completely the inverted situation that we see in India. So that can give a wealth of data exactly to patients exposed to JAK inhibitors. Okay, so Xenophon, any comments, closing comments on this?
Well, I don't have a closing comment. I will leave it to you, but generally speaking, I think it was well covered, all the issues. We also need to take into account that, as you mentioned, Sophia, in such study or analysis design, there may be also other interests of treating patients with this or that, not the interest of patients staying or not staying on the drug. This means we cannot exclude these biases based on the nature of the study. Nevertheless, on the other hand, one can argue that that's the data from daily practice. Yeah. So I think these studies are interesting and important, but they don't show the final, or they don't show us the final result. Still, we can at least see what is happening in the different settings.
I couldn't agree more with you, and I'm very happy that we close with a methodological comment of constraint about these studies, and it's good to be aware that those potential biases exist. Thank you very much for this fruitful discussion. And thank you to the audience for joining us for this AxSpA podcast brought to you by the Immune-Mediated Inflammatory Disease Forum. We really hope you found it useful. And if you did, please don't forget to subscribe to our channels on YouTube, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts from, so that you don't miss any future episodes. And if you want to read more about what we've discussed today, head over to the www.imidforum.com, where you will find the summary slides of both papers. See you next time.